Hey, everybody. I want to welcome you to the Free Man Beyond the Wall podcast. This is your host, Mance Rader. This is episode 95. It's going up on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, Evoox. It's going up on YouTube, my website, freemanbeyondthewall.com, and it's going to be on libertarianinstitute.org in the blog section. I want to remind you about my book, Freedom Through Memedom, The 31-Day Guide to Waking Up to Liberty. It is on Amazon. It is available for Kindle, so you can download it in a few seconds. If you have Kindle Unlimited, you can download it for free. Today, I'm welcoming back Scott Horton to the show. I think everybody knows Scott by now. He's a foreign policy expert, opinion editor at antiwar.com. He runs libertarianinstitute.org with Sheldon Richman. Today, Scott and I aren't going to talk about foreign policy. We're actually going to go back to the 90s and talk about a subject that he studied a lot back then, and he studied through the years. It is the Oklahoma City bombing. Much of what happened on that day has not been reported on, or it has been reported on, and you just haven't heard about it because it's not going to be reported in the news. Scott's going to talk about just exactly what happened that day, according to some great investigative journalism that's been done. Like I said, you haven't heard. So we talk a little foreign policy and a little Afghanistan at the end, and then we just shit talk a little bit. So without any further delay, here's Scott Horton. So what's going on, Scott?
Thanks for having me back, dude.
All right, man. All right. I could probably ask you about super depressing stuff in the present, like John Bolton getting appointed, and I don't want to talk about that stuff. Let's talk about depressing stuff in the past, because you have a lot more information on an event that people tend to forget about, not forget about, but to really put on the back burner because of 9/11. But April 19th, 1995, the Murrow Building in Oklahoma City just blows up. I remember walking into work that morning, and I was late, and it was on the radio, and I heard about it, and it seemed really, it was surreal. You know, we had gone through the 93, the bombing of the World Trade Center. Was that 92 or 93? 93. And so, but this was much worse. I mean, they were talking about a high body count almost immediately. What's the official story? If you were to go to Wikipedia, what does Wikipedia tell us happened on April 19th, 1995?
That an Army veteran named Timothy McVeigh, with help from his friend, also an Army veteran named Terry Nichols, built a fertilizer, ammonium nitrate bomb out of fertilizer and racing fuel. The number changes, but let's say for now, we'll get back to this maybe. A 4,800-pound, or maybe they have really officially raised it to now a 7,000-pound bomb in a Ryder truck parked outside. And they set it off at 9 o'clock that morning, killed 189 people in what was deemed to be revenge for the Waco massacre 2 years before. And so McVeigh then got in a yellow Mercury with no license plate and drove it on down the highway, got pulled over by a state trooper, had a gun on him, but surrendered the gun and surrendered himself to the state trooper. They took him to jail. I forgot what the pretext was for them actually taking him in. But while he was in jail, the local jail, you know, heard the APB out for this guy and realized this was the one they were looking for, this kind of thing. He and Nichols, his accomplice, who was in Kansas at the time, not with him, were both tried in federal court in Denver, Colorado, under Judge Mache, and they were both convicted. McVeigh of murder and conspiracy and all this in the murder of the federal agents who were killed there that day. And then Nichols, as I recall, and man, now I hope I'm right about this, but I think he was convicted only of manslaughter and possibly even of involuntary manslaughter, which was a compromise, kind of a protest. Not involuntary, but just manslaughter, I think it was. It was like a protest by the jurors themselves that they were unhappy with the case that was presented against this guy. That, you know, they knew that he had done something, but they weren't sure what. And so that was part of it. Maybe we can get back to that, too. But So that's more or less the official story. McVeigh was executed in the early summer of 2001, and Terry Nichols is still in prison. He was sentenced to life in prison by a state jury when he was prosecuted in Oklahoma for the other murders as well. And then that was pretty much it. And that was why the Waco massacre was okay, because this happened as revenge for it. And that's been my experience. I guess it's been a while, but it's not so much, you know, Waco's not so much the topic anymore. But for years and years, if I ever try to talk about Waco to whatever random person in whatever circumstance, the answer invariably was, well, what about Oklahoma City? As though the Branch Davidians had gotten in a time machine and gone forward to 95 and blown up Oklahoma City, which was the motive for the ATF and the FBI and the Army Delta Force's revenge against them 2 years before. When I don't remember it that way, but that was the way it worked, as you know, to forever, you know, defend and whitewash the Waco massacre by hiding it behind the Oklahoma bombing. And now, so you mentioned where you were that day and how it was. It was one of those events where you remember where you were that day. Well, I was in high school. I was a senior in high school, and I went to my friend's house. It was like a half-day thing. I went to my friend's house around noon, and his other friend was over there, a guy that I'd known for a while. I'd met him many times, and he was forced recon in the Marines in Vietnam. And he had told me some serious stories about the Vietnam War and stuff, too. And he was a serious guy. And when I got there, he was in the middle of pointing at the TV and saying, there was a contact explosive on this column here, here, and here. And my buddy says to me, hey, man, all day long they've been talking about the bombs inside the building that blew it up. And then now all of a sudden they've changed the story and they're saying it was a bomb parked outside. So I don't know. But his friend is sitting there and he tells me, that, look, I taught bomb-making school in the Marine Corps, you know. This is my job, is blowing up hard targets like this. And so now that it's funny because this is a huge part of what made me a Oklahoma revisionist from the very start, and a lot of other people as well. And I got to tell you, I should tell you right up front, and I'll make the case for it if you want me to as well, but I don't really buy this anymore because the best journalist on the story – of the Oklahoma bombing, J.D. Cash, is actually the guy that convinced me that, no, there really weren't bombs inside the building, not that way, not that were detonated, that the ATF, a big part of the story of the bombs inside was that there were three undetonated devices that were removed, that were, it was, the idea was that they had failed to go off for some reason, and then the bomb squad removed them. And J.D. Cash said, no, actually what it was the ATF office up there on the top floor, I guess it was, that they had a tow missile, and they had explosives and all kinds of ammunition and all kinds of stuff that they were not supposed to have up there, and that they called in these fake bomb threats in order to pull everybody back just so they can get, you know, avoid getting in trouble. And which is funny because it's not funny. If you go back and look, and I have a file somewhere I'll send you of all my audio clips of this. And you may even be able to find on YouTube now a collection of video clips from local news of the Oklahoma City bombing, where over and over, because of these alleged bomb threats, if they found another undetonated device, they called off all the rescue efforts. And there are direct quotes of people, direct quotes of the rescuers saying, I had to leave this woman behind and she begged me not to go. And then, of course, by the time I got back, she was dead. And people, you know, they were forced to abandon their rescue efforts over and over again all day. That was a big part of what reinforced the idea that there really were bombs in the building for people who were paying that close of attention to the story. But then it turns out, you know, according to J.D. Cash, that was actually cover just for, boy, we got to get this tow missile out of here, guys, and this kind of thing. But anyway, I'm off on my tangent. Go ahead, ask me some more things.
Okay. So, this is actually 2 years to the day of the final of day 51 of Waco,
right?
When the tanks went in and put in the gas and the, well, we know.
It was also the day of the scheduled execution of a white supremacist named Richard Snell, and he was actually executed that day.
Do you remember what state?
Or somewhere in the southeast.
Okay.
I forget.
All right, so.
Might have been Arkansas.
If I remember correctly, this was the reports that came out after this. There was a lot of talk about militias. And this was used as an excuse to try and take down militias. I mean, Ruby Ridge was sort of used as an excuse, you know, militia this, and even Waco, the way they tried to talk about the weapons and everything there, they were planning for something. But were these guys militia members?
No. I mean, well, first of all, after Ruby Ridge and then especially after Waco, there were militias cropping up everywhere. And they were not white supremacist militias. They were no more Waco's militias. And you know, for one example, Bill Curtis from Investigative Reports on A&E went and talked to different militia groups around the country and was like, you know what? These are okay guys. I mean, maybe their fears are a bit overinflated, but it's not like they're about to do anything unless their overinflated fears come true. So what really is the big deal, man? They're actually good old boys who are saying they just don't want to see this kind of thing again. And after all, none of us want to see this kind of thing again, right? I mean, what the hell? If we can't all agree that the local sheriff should have kicked the FBI the hell off of the Branch Davidians property, you know, back 3 days after they got there, then what the hell are we doing in a society together right now? I mean, goddamn. Sorry, but, so, there's got to be a better way. And that was, you know, supposedly, as I'm sure you've heard this myth before, but in America, the people are sovereign. The people are born free is the idea. And we allow the government to be our security force. We're citizens, not subjects. They're not supposed to be our overlords. They're supposed to be our security force. And so, yeah, if the men of the neighborhood have arms and join an organization and say, we're not going to let anyone, federal government or anyone else, butcher women and children around here, then, yeah, good. You know, that's exactly in the spirit of the Declaration of Independence, perfectly. And now, a lot of these guys are sort of populist, right-wing patriot movement guys, but I think that milieu was much less racist back then than they are now, honestly. And there were many, much fewer of them back then, too. And there was, in my experience back then, there was a real dividing line between the militias and even the Republic of Texas. I knew some of those guys and people who were like neo-Nazis and the Aryan Nations and all these kinds of things. Those were totally separate groups. And I'm pretty sure they're pretty damn separate now, too. I'm not trying to smear anybody these days. I just know much less about it these days, about the different militias. But back then, I mean, I knew these guys, and they didn't talk about blacks and Jews. They talked about the New World Order, and they talked about the Rothschilds, but they didn't even know the Rothschilds were Jewish. They were just, it was the Rockefeller, Rothschild, John Birch conspiracy, which does not emphasize Judaism. It just emphasizes one world government and the United Nations and that kind of thing. And they, you know, I mean, I knew these guys. They didn't talk that way. But so, back to Oklahoma City now, was McVeigh and his guys, and this is the core of our story here, is that McVeigh was a Nazi. And his buddies were Nazis that helped him do the bombing. And so then what did the guard, and he was not a militia guy. You know, he'd like gone to a meeting of the Michigan militia before, but he'd never joined it and they didn't accept him. I don't know if he even tried to join it, but whatever. It just never had happened. Like Zarqawi and Osama, it just wasn't a thing. until later, I guess, in that case. Sorry. But yes, you're absolutely right that then Bill Clinton and the entire mainstream media basically said everybody to the right of Rush Limbaugh and maybe even including him were the anti-government extremists in America who are all responsible for the Oklahoma City bombing. And the militia movement is basically, you know, like this seditious armed insurgent threat, against the Bill Clinton government just waiting to break out and all this. And they just, you know, again, you know, overshadowed by 9/11 in a conspiracy theory way, too, is the Oklahoma bombing, where the conspiracy theory, certainly as I believed it at the time, I was, you know, I think I was being overly simplistic, and I did hedge even back then, but I was a lot younger and a lot more willing to leap to conclusions than to think that they actually provoked this thing, and it didn't just get out of control, that they did it on purpose just so that they could exploit it, just so that they could demonize the, you know, outside of the Republican Party, right, in America, and, you know, try to nip this militia thing in the bud as fast as they could. And that was the best way to do it. And I don't believe that, but for the same reason that people believe the 9/11 truth stuff is, how do you explain them exploiting it in the most cynical fashion that you couldn't possibly make up for them? You know, and that's really the case here, too, is they exploited it so cynically in blaming innocent people and letting the guilty go free at the very same time.
I remember that there were, it really wasn't until much later that I saw this, but in the early 2000s, getting into the mid 2000s, people started talking about, I mean, they started talking about it immediately, but websites started popping up about how in the truck with McVeigh was, they saw a Middle Eastern man. And I remember in 2004, maybe even into 2005, Glenn Beck had on his website, on the front page of his website, like right at the top, a banner to click through to learn the truth about the Middle East connection to the Oklahoma City bombing. So what are,
I'm glad you brought that up. I mean, it had to come up sooner or later, but sooner's good. That's all a big fake red herring. And there was an NBC reporter from the local affiliate there in Oklahoma City named Jaina Davis, who actually did some really great work on the Oklahoma bombing about, for example, the ATF's prior knowledge of the attack and the existence of video showing the entire thing and a lot of other great stories. But she got caught up in this whole red herring that it was an Iraqi named Hussein al-Husseini and his four Palestinian painting crew guys because they had a brown pickup truck. In fact, the brown pickup truck is really tied to a friend of McVeigh, a Nazi from Arizona, and was not, had nothing to do with these guys. But it was this huge red herring that it was an Iraqi and some Palestinians here who were McVeigh's accomplice. And so then this kind of took all the wind out of the sail of the true revisionist account of what really was going on here and appropriated it for Cheneyite ends, and quite literally, because, of course, with the Iraqi connection, you draw in Lori Milroy from the American Enterprise Institute and her cohort, the now infamous Judy Miller from the New York Times, who did so much to lie us into war on the basis of Saddam Hussein's alleged nuclear weapons program in 2002 and 2003, and was, you know, Scooter Libby's asset, basically, in whatever all ways. And so they pushed this whole thing, and Milroy published a book called Saddam Hussein's Unfinished War with the United States, and there was a sequel as well, and I think Judy Miller was the co-author on the sequel. And the basis of all of this was to try to claim that there was no real al-Qaeda, that al-Qaeda was a front for Iraqi intelligence. And the core of their argument was that Ramzi Youssef, the first World Trade Center bomber, Abdul Basit is his real name, and the nephew of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, that he is not really Abdul Basit, that actually the Iraqis killed him and stole his identity. And this is an Iraqi Mukhbarat agent, and he's the one who did the first World Trade Center bombing, and he's the one who tried to blow up the UN and the Lincoln and Holland tunnels and the other New York landmarks, and he's the one who came up with the Bojinka plot. Oh, and in 1993 also, after the first World Trade Center bombing, you might remember there was a guy who at the double left turn lane, he blocked the double left turn lane, got an AK out of his trunk, and he killed three CIA officers on their way to work in the morning. And he got away. He escaped to Pakistan. And he was not tied to Saddam Hussein or to al-Qaeda. Although it's a footnote in my book, the headlines of the stories of his prosecution, the government's theory of the case was he was mad about American support for Israel and the blockade and bombing of Iraq, and that was why he did it, if that sounds familiar. But Milroy said that this was another one, and also threw in Oklahoma City, and said that this is all part of Saddam Hussein's war against America as revenge for Iraq War I, which obviously makes no sense whatsoever, considering the position Saddam Hussein was in the 1990s. But if you look at the history, and this is in my book, And people, and it's all footnotes. I'm not the reporter, but I got a lot of footnotes, that on September 11th and 12th and 13th and 15th and what have you, you have Donald Rumsfeld and Paul Wolfowitz pushing Lori Milroy's. Yeah, but Al-Qaeda is really just a front for Iraq anyway, isn't it? And the CIA and the FBI and Richard Clark and the rest of the actual professional state government people saying, no, dude, this is not true. Stop it with this. You know, but Wolfowitz and, you know, Lynn Cheney had done the foreword for one of Milroy's books and everything. You know, this was the AEI consensus, and they meant to push it whether it was true or not. You know, it's a matter of cultish belief in a way, kind of half belief, half know you're lying, but keep pushing anyway kind of thing, you know? Mm-hmm. So no, there was no Middle East connection. It's all complete nonsense. Now, part of it too was that, Terry Nichols had gone to the Philippines. Now, he'd gone to the Philippines for deniability that I didn't blow anybody up. I was in the Philippines. It was why he was there. But then they said, oh, the Philippines. Well, that's where Cebu City is, and that's where Ramzi Youssef was. And then there was an informant who had claimed that he had saw a white guy, the farmer they called him, and he had taken bomb school with Ramzi Youssef. But that was bullshit. That was basically, you know, I forget now, honestly, off the top of my head how debunked it was. But I think even the Philippine police who got the confession said that this wasn't really true, that they had sort of put these words in his mouth and he went for it, but it didn't really add up, that you know, Nichols had done that. And the so-called bomb that they built, assuming that they did, they wouldn't have needed any instruction from Ramzi Youssef how to do that anyway. You know, barrels full of ammonium nitrate and fuel oil. It's get the mixture mostly right and it'll work, you know.
So there is on the day this happened, and I think going forward for a couple of days, the weight of the bomb just kept changing.
So
how far up did it go?
Well, you know, so it, and this all happened in one day. And this is in that local news footage. I hope it's on YouTube somewhere, man. It must be by now. I do have all the audio clips, so I'll send you a link to the – I have like a folder of audio clips on my server, I think. But you can hear them say that the car bomb, the original estimate we're being told by – officials, ATF officials, I guess, is that a car bomb with, and this is the first time they start saying it's a car bomb after they've been saying that the building blew up from the inside all day. But anyway, and they could have just been wrong about that. But anyway, they go 2,400 pound car bomb blew up the building, and that's the explanation. And then, no, I'm sorry, I'm starting the story in the middle. First they say 1,200, and the guy says even, he goes, with as much as 1,200 pounds of explosives. And he's just a local news guy, but it's him compensating his own cognitive dissonance that, you know, I don't know, for a bomb outside, I don't know, 1,200 pounds. And so he's trying to kind of, in his own mind, rationalize by making that 100 sound like a big 100. And then later they double it, and you go, yeah, oh, now they're saying it was as much as 2,400 pounds of explosives. And then just later in the day, 4,800 pounds. It was a 4,800 pound truck bomb. And then they stuck with 4,800, which they clearly had just made up after exactly doubling it twice from their original made up estimate. And they stuck with that all the way through both trials. And that was it. And the only evidence for it was that there was a different weight than that on a receipt that supposedly had McVeigh's thumbprint on it for fertilizer that they found at Terry Nichols' house. And they said, this is it. And then their scientist who testified at the trial, Dave Williams, was basically caught under cross-examination, forced to admit that he had made up his science about finding ammonium nitrate crystals in this board left over from the truck where he said he had found them and that the evidence was faked. And he'd been called out by the famous FBI crime lab whistleblower Frederick Whitehurst on that. And Whitehurst testified against him, you know, or against his point of view in the trial, which – you know, not to say that Nichols or McVeigh were innocent, but that part of the story, they never proved it. And it's not to say that it was definitely not an ammonium nitrate bomb either, but it's just to say that they sure didn't have the evidence. They basically went with trust us. And this is a real theme. I think the most important or one of the major important points about the McVeigh trial, especially in the federal court in Denver, was that they never even put him at the scene of the crime. They, you know, the only video that they showed was one still shot of the truck driving by on the far side of the street, maybe stopped at a red light. But you can't see who's in it. It's just, it's a Ryder truck. And if you say that that was the date and time it was taken, then okay. But it's still down the street on its way there. It's not there. And we don't see McVeigh in it. And then they didn't interview anyone who put him at the scene of the crime. And I'm here to tell you there's 24, that's the camera angles. There's at least a dozen something witnesses that placed McVeigh in Oklahoma City that morning in a yellow Ryder truck, such as Mike Mraz, the guy at the tire shop who gave them directions to the building. And so this is where we get to the guy riding shotgun. There was a guy there, but it was either Michael Brescia or Richard Guthrie. That's like, you know, probably 99% if I'm that broad with it. Those guys were white supremacists, and maybe, you know, white supremacists can be Mexican sometimes, or God knows what, maybe pretty olive-skinned, but not an Arab, neither of them Arabs. But, you know, somebody could make that mistake. Witnesses don't know what the hell they're talking about a lot of the times. But here's what they didn't all mistake. They all saw McVeigh with somebody else. No one saw him alone. They couldn't even find anyone to say, well, I only saw him, but there may have been someone else. They couldn't even find that. They could only find people who saw him with somebody else that day, and then as well as many, many witnesses previous to that. So they didn't call any of them. Instead, they called a young girl whose mother and sister, I think, had died when they were on their way to the Social Security Administration office. And they asked her, how sad do you feel? And she said, very, very sad. And then they said to the jury, man, you see that shit? And the jury was like, my God. And then they convicted him based on that. And again, I'm not saying he's innocent. I'm just saying they didn't dare put up the evidence required to prove their case because it would have implicated somebody else, and it would have implicated their case for falling so far short. And wait, I'm going to play this one clip for you because I'm 90%. I can pull it right up here. Oh, don't screw me over like that. No library results. All right, give me a minute.
Sure.
Ask me something else.
Okay.
And I'm going to find this clip for you, too, because it's, you know what? Let me see if I just search OKC here. As long as you're giving me a minute. Nah, I'm sorry. I'll have to go digging through the folder to find it. But I'll just tell you. It's a juror interviewed on 60 Minutes says, you know, I was just waiting for the defense to call a witness to come and say, no, it couldn't have been McVeigh because he was with me that day. But that never happened. And then that's it. So in other words, the burden of proof was on him to disprove that he did it. And this was the kind of, she didn't mean to be unfair, right? She's rationalizing the fact that the prosecution didn't really convince her that he did it, other than the fact that they're putting on this entire dog and pony show in an effort to show that they believe he did it. So he must have done it, I mean, right? Just the same as you and I are saying it. But they didn't prove that he did it. Now, I think the conspiracists, so-called, who say that all his Nazi friends helped him do it, do a better job of proving he did it than the prosecution, because they actually cite Mike Mraz saying, that was Timothy McVeigh, all right, but he had somebody else riding shotgun. You know? So, and they have a much more consistent narrative as far as, you know, the Aryan Republican Army bank robbery ring that were the accomplices here, and the FBI investigation that, you know, apparently the Nazis fooled. For example, there were two Ryder trucks, one the FBI was following and one that was the truck bomb. And in fact, the ATF or the local bomb squad or some kind of bomb squad guys were there in the morning, starting at 7 a.m. and left at 8, and the bomb went off at 9. And that's a whole tangent. If you want me to go, I'll start talking about, in, you know, solid proofs of prior knowledge or whichever direction you want to go.
Well, let's talk about this. Now, I'll bring this up and we can talk about it now or talk about it later. The largest terrorist attack on American soil in history, well, I would say it happened in Oklahoma to to a black town back in the 20s, but we'll leave that for another podcast.
Yeah, the Tulsa riots.
Yeah, the Tulsa riots. But
for how they, wounded knee, man.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
but they never did a congressional hearing on this. Nothing was investigated. And from what I've heard is that there may have been a man on the inside.
Well, so here's the thing about that. Virtually all of these Nazis were flip states witnesses or were undercover informants or in one way or another were compromised by the feds and therefore also compromised the feds that they were working for. And that includes Carol Howe, who was the ATF informant, who was informing the ATF all about what these FBI informants were up to. And ask me about her in a second. But when it comes to an actual inside man, as in made it happen on purpose, the best case for that is against André Karl Strassmeier, who was a German army intelligence officer who was working for the DEA and the FBI and different people at different times. At one point, to get around post-Waco regulations, they had outsourced his handling to the SPLC, and he was reporting to Morris Dees and them, who were reporting back to the FBI.
Wait, say that again? You're talking about the Southern Poverty Law Center.
That's right.
Okay.
Klan Watch. It started as Klan Watch. Admirable enough mission. But so post Waco, there were new regulations meant to, you know, prevent things from getting too far out of hand against big groups and this kind of thing. And so part of the Oklahoma thing was Strassmeier was at Elohim City, which was this compound in eastern Oklahoma where all these Nazis basically hung out and lived. And he became the head of security there and this and that. So the FBI, in order to get around restrictions on their ability to run their informants, at least for a time, used Morris Dees and the SPLC as like cutouts, basically, to help run André Strassmeier. And this is in some of the documents that J.D. Cash had unearthed, and he had confronted Morris Dees about this. And I'm not sure which one, but you can hear J.D. Cash describe all of this in one of my interviews of him in the archives there, where he talks all about this. And, man, I'd have to go back and find you a footnote maybe about, you know, the actual documents that show this. But it's true. J.D. Cash couldn't have made that up. None of us could. That was part of it. And I don't know how meaningful that is in terms of, you know, people want to jump to conclusions about, well, so the SPLC did the bombing or whatever. I'm not saying that, but I'm saying that they were involved in and had a relationship with André Strassmeier sort of on behalf of the FBI, at least for a time. And then the idea would be that, yeah, that he wasn't really a Nazi, that he was an infiltrator here and that his job was to provoke. Now, as we've seen over and over again, especially in this century, you know, having the job of provoking doesn't necessarily indicate that they want an attack to be successful, right? I mean, they do this all the time. This is the story of the first World Trade Center bombing attack, that they had an undercover informant in there. Not that they had originated the plot. They hadn't. But they did have basically a walk-in informant who said, man, I'm right in the best position here. They've asked me to build the bomb. So then the plan was they were going to make a fake explosive and then catch these guys in the act. But then the supervisors wouldn't go along with the agent's plan, the FBI agent's plan, and they basically, more or less, they cut the guy off, the informant off. And so then it was Ramzi Youssef, Abdul Basset, who was eventually brought in to actually build the real bomb that killed six people but could have killed 50,000 or some nightmare if one of those towers had toppled into the other. But anyway, so this is a thing we've seen this over and over and over again with these entrapment jobs in America where, you know, the FBI give them the benefit of the doubt on any particular case for their motives anyway. They see somebody who they think is really dangerous and has a political motive to do something really stupid and horrible. And so they send an informant to say, hey, will you agree to a plan to do this terrible thing with me? And then that person says yes. And they go, aha, gotcha. Right. Or click this button and you'll set off a fake bomb, whatever. So in this case, it could be that. And I think actually that really is the Occam's razor explanation here, is that they had these dangerous Nazis who wanted to do this bombing, and they thought that they could handle it. Like John Kerry talking about the Islamic State in Syria, we thought we could manage. and then the thing gets out of control. And such as I think that's the key to the two truck bomb, to the two Ryder trucks, is that one of them had the FBI's GPS on it, and the other one was the truck bomb. And they were off chasing the wrong thing, you know? Because the Nazis, they weren't stupid, you know? They knew. So
what about Karen?
Hence the cover-up. And you know what? And so here's the thing, too, man, because a lot of this may sound crazy, so maybe I should have said this at the beginning. But FBI officials have admitted that I'm right, that this whole story stinks to high heaven, and that all the people I point my finger at are actually likely responsible, such as Danny Colson, the FBI agent who helped run the investigation. And if you read the book Oklahoma City by Gumbel and Charles, then you'll see where it's a ridiculous statement, kind of full of double and triple negatives. You know, but he basically says the U.S. attorney says, if you took me and all the federal prosecutors on this case and made us raise our hand, if we thought that guilty people got away with it that we didn't get, then the answer is yes. We would agree to that, that that was true, that they let them get away. And their rationalization was that they didn't want to jeopardize the death penalty case against McVeigh. This is their excuse. I shouldn't say rationalization. I don't know if this really was their reasoning at all. This may just be a made-up excuse for just covering the FBI agents' asses for allowing the attack to happen on their watch in the first place or what. But the way that they put it, this was their best argument for themselves after conceding that much, I guess, is a way to put it, that, well, we didn't want to jeopardize the death penalty case against McVeigh by chasing all these other guilty guys, because then that would raise reasonable doubt as to whether McVeigh was anything but the stooge behind the steering wheel. And they didn't want to do that. So, you know, instead of giving 15 guy or 10 guys life, they executed one and gave life to another.
You were talking about Carol Howe?
Yeah, Carol Howe. So Carol Howe was a former white supremacist. She was the daughter of a prominent politician in Louisiana, I think. And not too prominent, but, you know, kind of a mid-level politician, I believe. And she was a former white supremacist, but she'd been badly mistreated by her boyfriend or something, so she decided to betray them and went to the ATF and said, I can tell you all this stuff about all these guys. And they used her, and she had big swastika tattoos on her arms and all this stuff, so, you know, she seemed legit. And she was able to infiltrate Elohim City. And what she was reporting back to ATF was that these guys are preparing an attack. And in the book, it's got a stupid name, but this is just the publisher. It's just business. The book has solid journalism in it, okay? It's called The Secret Life of Bill Clinton. And it's not even about that at all. It's not about his womanizing and this kind of crap. It has nothing to do with that. It's about the Oklahoma bombing and about, you know, drug running in MENA, Arkansas for George Bush and Ronald Reagan, okay? And Waco. So in there, he has the transcript of the deposition with Angela Finley. She got married and changed her last name, but anyways, Finley is one of her last names, the ATF handler of Carol Howe, where she is forced to concede, after trying to argue about it for a minute in this deposition, that actually, yes, it's true that Carol Howe came and picked her up and drove her around Oklahoma City and pointed out, these are the buildings we were casing when I was driving around with Andre Strassmeyer and these other Nazis from Elohim City. And that this was before the bombing, that she tried to warn him of this. Now, there was an airplane ride between where ATF and FBI were on the plane, and it was Bob Ricks, who I'm sure I'm under the impression, Mance, that you've seen Waco, The Rules of Engagement,
yes,
lately.
Yes.
And there's the clip of Bob Ricks saying, we put massive gas in there. The women and children had to be suffering. Why didn't they care about their children?
He's a fucking bastard.
Well, he became the head of the Tulsa office after that. And he was the guy who told the ATF to back off. We're not going to let you screw this up like you screwed up Waco for everybody. We're going to handle this. But then they didn't handle nothing. And the bombing happened on Bob Rick's watch anyway. And so then this massive cover-up where it was just this one guy. And now go back to, you know, you mentioned that a Middle Eastern guy or whatever, but, you know, dial it down even one point from that. What about just John Doe too? This was the story. These two guys did it. These two guys are fugitives. They're on the run. Where are they at? Oh, Turns out John Doe 1's already in jail and busted. And where's John Doe 2? And then, oh yeah, by the way, there is no John Doe 2. Forget about John Doe 2. Even though, again, every witness who saw McVeigh that day saw him with somebody else. And everybody saw him in the weeks before that saw him with other people. It never happened. It was all a big mistake. And all the different people who say that they saw him, from the people who rented the truck and the people who saw him that day and the people at the motel and all the rest of it, they're just all not credible. And what they think, it just doesn't matter. What they say doesn't matter. And, you know, under pressure, I guess the guy at the rental truck store said, you know, I guess I could have been confusing him with somebody else who came in the day before, you know, if that's what you want me to say, something like that. But, you know, and this is the thing. So I'll just name names and I guess they can sue me or whatever, but this is all just very public information. I'm not the investigative journalist on this. I just, and honestly, it's been a long, long time since I've done real work on it at all. But I cared a lot about it then. I did a lot of, you know, paid a lot of attention to it then. But it's Michael Brescia and Richard Guthrie. And ask me about Guthrie again in a second. Yeah. You're good at that. Michael Brescia and Richard Guthrie, Mark Thomas and Peter Langan and Andre Strassmeyer and,
Peter Langan was a big time Nazi, right?
Yeah, he was. And he was supposedly, he was the cross dresser. He's dressed as a woman that day out in the middle of the street, directing traffic to help McVeigh park the truck. That was one of the arguments anyway.
That's insane.
And so now let me ask you this, man. You've been around for a little while. Remember they used to show on Cops and Real Stories of the Highway Patrol all the time this footage of an old gray and white, gray and blue Suburban pulled over on the side of the road and a shootout between these two Nazis and this cop. And it goes on for like 3 minutes and just pow, 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 pow. And nobody hits anybody the whole time. And they end up going to jail. You remember that?
You know what's crazy? We, in the gun community, they actually use that video to show that, you know, you can get into a gunfight at close range and never hit anybody. It's actually used as a training tool. But yeah, I mean, I've seen that, you know, at least 10, 20 times.
Okay, so that's Shane and Chevy Kehoe, and they're a couple of Nazis, and at least one of them, I forget which it was, knew about the Oklahoma City bombing. And at his trial, the guy that ran the local motel said, I think it was Chevy, showed up that morning at 6 o'clock in the morning and said, turn it to CNN, something big is going to happen. And he sat there on the edge of his seat all morning long, and then when the Oklahoma bombing happened, he started hooting and hollering and clapping his hands and saying, we did it, etc. That's the guy from your famous handgun training video. He was one of the Nazis who knew about this.
Did the guy who worked in the motel, did he come forward quickly and anything?
I don't know about that. All I know is he was a prosecution witness.
Okay.
And I remember seeing that on Court TV, you know, back when. Is that still a thing?
I don't even know. Okay. I know where you're going with this because I want to say, I don't know if you've ever, there's a documentary out there that talks about Trinidu. And I downloaded it off of, I don't remember if you remember a torrent site that's been gone a couple years, consen.org or something like that. And they had like the coolest, like homemade documentaries of all this conspiracy stuff and everything. But when I watched this one on Guthrie, somebody thinking that it was Guthrie and somebody becoming a victim, it absolutely floored me. And it actually started me asking questions about Oklahoma City. So jump into Guthrie.
Yeah. All right. Now, so there's this guy named Kenneth Trinidu. He was a former bank robber. And he had been on the lam in Mexico, basically. Was, you know, for, I think, skipping parole. And on his way back into the country from Mexico, he got nabbed at the border. And they took him to a federal transfer facility outside of Tulsa, Oklahoma. This is in the summer of 1995. And then he was beaten to death in his prison cell there. And the Bureau of Prisons said, called his brother, Jesse, and or his mother, back in Utah, and said, yeah, well, your son committed suicide here. So we're going to burn his corpse and then see you later. Well, their problem was is that Kenneth's brother, Jesse, is a lawyer. And so he said, no, you don't. And he filed the proper paperwork in the proper way where they couldn't get away with that. And they put his corpse on a plane back to Utah. And if you just put Kenneth Trenadue in Google Images, I'm sorry, avert your eyes, but then look anyway. And it's his, you know, brutally beaten and battered corpse. And he clearly was tortured to death, beaten to death over, you know, a pretty brutal fight. I won't describe all the injuries. I forget the list. So Jesse started suing to find out what the hell happened here. And I guess he only got so far. And then one day he got a letter from Timothy McVeigh that said, I know what happened to your brother. He was mistaken for a guy named Richard Guthrie. And I'm not sure what else the letter said or what all it said, the language of it. I could find out, I guess. You know, Jesse Trenadue was like, I don't know. You know, he didn't really do anything with it. He didn't know what to do with it. And then some period of time later, he got a call from J.D. Cash, the heroic journalist on this case. And J.D. Cash said, I think I know what happened to your brother. Are you sitting down? They mistook him for Richard Guthrie. He was John Doe, too, in the Oklahoma City bombing. And then so the idea is that either he refused to admit that he was Guthrie, and so, you know, them trying to beat that confession out of him resulted in this, or that just they knew that the story is McVeigh did it himself with only Nichols, you know, once removed help from the scene of the crime, and that there's no other justice for Guthrie other than this, and they just punished him for Guthrie's crime in this way by murdering him. Or maybe they were rude to him when they fed him his tray and he, you know, gave him the finger, and I don't, you know, nobody knows exactly, right? But, you know, something like this seems pretty likely, that because of their mistaken conclusion that he was Guthrie, that was what resulted in his death. So Jesse decided then, with J.D. Cash's help and all of J.D. Cash's great journalism and investigation of this story, he took this to federal court in Utah, where the judge doesn't give a damn about the Department of Justice politics in Washington, D.C. And this particular judge has been, you know what, I shouldn't characterize him as pro-Trenadue really in any way necessarily, but he certainly seems to just be fair in terms of does this man have standing to sue for these documents? You're damn right he does. And did he just prove again that the FBI is not being forthcoming? Yes, he did. And am I now getting upset because the FBI is trying my patience? Yes, I am. And so this happens sometimes with a pseudo-independent judiciary such as we have here, and it's one of those cases where it really has worked to our advantage. And Jesse has just, he's been suing him for years, and he won a big settlement at some point. And he continues to get documents and documents and documents. And I don't have a current page up now, but I do have a link to, I guess, a folder full of documents somewhere. I can find it for you. Maybe it is a page somewhere on one of my sites. Maybe I'll see if I can find it for you. And it's quite disorganized, but it's all of my Jesse Trenadue PDF files of all of his court stuff. And by the way, when I was traveling a couple of weeks ago, a guy emailed me and said, oh, he had heard me do an interview where I had dismissed the claims of a pro-conspiracist, but who I didn't think her claims added up to much. And he liked that I wasn't just, you know, going with whatever all, you know, spaghetti people are flinging at the wall, but I'm trying to really be careful about what I think is credible or not. And so he went and looked more and found all the interviews I'd done with Cash and found my Trenadue documents and all of this stuff. And he seemed like he was really serious, and he was taking this on as a major research project to have sort of the ultimate, you know, compiled what we know by 2018 kind of take on Oklahoma City, which would be very useful to me because honestly, I'm way behind on it now. So I'm really looking forward to that. But so the single best article about Jesse Trenadue and his story of pursuing justice for the killing of his innocent brother here, Kenneth, is, I think, In Search of John Doe 2. at Mother Jones by James Ridgway. And he also, at least at one point, they had a great collection of his documents too. So it's just real. And, you know, Eric Holder was the guy who had the job in the Clinton Justice Department of telling Congress to not let them investigate the murder of Kenneth Trenodieu. And Orrin Hatch at one point, there's video, I think, of Orrin Hatch saying, and he was the senator from Utah. Maybe still is the senator from Utah. Maybe he died. I can't keep track of this shit. I'm getting old, man. But Orrin Hatch was saying, yes, this is totally important, and it's one of my constituents, and you're damn right we're going to have hearings, and this and that, and then it never happened. He gave a statement like that to Fox News as though he really cared, and then, no, it didn't happen. And then in the documents, they're mocking, the staffers at DOJ are mocking Jesse and saying, yes, we're sending Eric over to the Senate to get more or less the, I'm paraphrasing this part of it, I forget exactly, but to lay down the Trenodieus and the Trenodonts of what you're allowed to, proceed with this, which ended up meaning no hearings at all, ever, not even on the Trenodieu case, much less the Oklahoma bombing. And think about that. You made that point earlier, but then you went on and asked me something different. But just think about that alone, how important that is, that after the Republican Revolution, the anti-Bill Clinton Revolution of 1994, when the House Oversight Committee was run by crazy Dan Burton, who was shooting melons in the backyard to prove about what happened to Vince Foster, right, who would stop at nothing to get Bill Clinton, and Arlen Specter and all these guys supposedly were the anti-Clinton faction going after him in the U.S. Senate, and they didn't hold a single hearing on any aspect of the Oklahoma City bombing? On any aspect of it. And why? It can only be because the Department of Justice insisted that, no, you just are forbidden from doing it. You may not. And they said, okay, we'll just let the sleeping dog lie. Nobody gives a shit anyway. Everybody cares about O.J. Simpson instead. Ooh, did you hear? A famous black guy killed a white girl. Don't you give a shit? Doesn't that matter to you as much as, you know, some people getting away with mass murder of 186 people, none of whom were the ATF agents in the building who were the target, by the way, who were all somehow aware that they shouldn't be at work that morning and were gone, but meanwhile included a daycare full of babies. And everybody's out chasing, oh, what really happened to Nicole Simpson? Well, O.J. cut her throat. Shut up. Who cares? Jesus Christ, one black guy gets away with a killing while 1,000 black guys go to jail for crimes they didn't commit. It balances out. You know, isn't that the ratio from Voltaire or whoever back in the day? That one innocent man go free and all this? So, Jesus.
Yeah, the
there was a book called The Oklahoma Bombing and the Politics of Terror by a guy named Hoffman, and that was his last chapter, chapter 8, I think it was called Let Them Eat O.J. That, like, you stupid, pathetic Americans, here, be placated with your little Hollywood story, you children.
Well,
you know?
Well, I've even heard you say, referring to Waco during the 51 days, that you heard Texas housewives saying, why don't they just fucking go in there and kill them, because I want to watch my soap operas.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, I was sacking groceries. I was 15 sacking groceries at the store in, you know, very comfortable Northwest Austin, Texas. And the idea was, these are bad people, man. They're basically a foreign nation. They might as well be, you know, yellow Japs. And so go ahead and nuke them, man. Who cares? You know, the problem is, I'm trying to watch One Life to Live, and instead I got to watch the Koresh show, and I don't want to. And so, what the hell is going on here? And, you know, they wouldn't say, kill the kids, burn the kids, right? They would just say, go in there and end it. But we know what that means, right? That means shoot machine gun bullets at anybody between you and the guy until the thing is no longer a fight. That's what it means. It means overwhelming force, the Colin Powell doctrine. Go in there and end it. And yeah, that's a direct quote of some nice lady from my neighborhood. And then her friend chiming in, yeah, because he said he was Jesus. And I think I did get in trouble for this, because I go, oh, he said he was Jesus. I guess we should nail him to a tree, huh?
You're breaking up, Scott. Like, Scott.
Oh, I'm breaking up right when I'm yelling the loudest. I says, oh, he says he's Jesus. Maybe we should nail him to a tree, huh? And, you know.
Yeah, you probably, that was you probably caught shit that, for yeah, that.
You,
yeah.
can't, you can't say things I don't like or I'll have the cops kill you.
The, yeah, it just seems amazing to me that the ATF and the FBI murder a bunch of people, murder less than 100 people in Texas, and you get a congressional hearing. You know, a domestic terrorist blow up a federal building, killing kids, killing infants, killing over almost 200 people, and there's no congressional hearing for it. I mean, come on. You have to ask, if you're not asking yourself why, you're just not being honest with yourself. The cognitive dissonance is just way too thick.
Yeah. Now, here's the thing, too. Let me claim here, now that we're this far into it, again, to sort of reiterate that you really don't have anything but me saying, trust me that there's a lot of good journalism about this Elohim City thing. Well, trust me, that's true. Go ahead and do the work there. But I will say, for what it's worth, that for anyone who kind of thinks of this as more fringe, like right-wing conspiracy, sort of trutherism and this kind of thing, that over at the New America Foundation, which is sort of CFR Jr., very acceptable center-left kind of Brookings institution, Steve Clemens and Anne-Marie Slaughter, and Peter Bergen, the CNN terrorism expert who interviewed Osama bin Laden, remember him, they're all cool with this, and they hosted an event with Andrew Gumbel, where he explains all about this, and the noted terrorism expert, to whatever degree you accept, J.M. Berger, has also written a lot about these neo-Nazis and the nexus to the Oklahoma bombing there with the Aryan Republican Army bank robbery ring and Elohim City and the rest of this. You know, this was part of why McVeigh's execution was delayed in 2001. Dan Rather had a scoop where three FBI agents came out and said, we did a bunch of work on Oklahoma City that we know was never turned over to the defense. And so there was an outcry because this ain't fair. And McVeigh said, yes, the process is the process. So he ordered his lawyers to ask for a stay, and they got one in order to review the evidence. And then they execute him anyway because he's guilty as hell anyway. But then I interviewed one of those FBI agents. Rick Ojeda was his name. And Rick Ojeda said that he had developed information about Elohim City that he knew still hadn't been turned over to the defense. Not just that he had some stuff, but 302s that he had written about Elohim City that he knew had not been turned over and that they were still suppressing or had maybe already completely destroyed. And so I never could get him back on the show after that. I tried calling that number. I guess he had me on, not this guy.
Is there anything I've tried to think of everything that I possibly can as far as this case. I mean, obviously we could get in the weeds here for hours if we really wanted to, but is there anything in an overview that we've forgotten?
No, I think that's pretty much it. I would say the best key word is J.D. Cash. I'm not sure at this point where is the best archive of all of his work here. I really should be doing it myself here, but man, I got a lot to do. But you know, I am really excited. I'm sorry, I forget the guy's name, but I am really excited about this guy that emailed me. He seemed like he really had his act together and was going to, you know, really try to do a compendium of all of the very best information about this, in an up-to-date kind of fashion. Cause you know, like I say, I was young and more of a conspiracy nut at the time. My first introduction to dissent on the issue was that day, and it was somebody saying bombs inside. And so I came from the already assuming my conclusion bad on this thing from day one. So, you know, I may not be the best judge of how right I am to this day, although I think you probably tell I've dialed down a little bit of my claims about what I think was going on behind it. From what I assumed back then, frankly. But at the same time, do I think that these Aryan Republican Army guys were McVeigh's friends that were in on it with him? Yeah. I mean, you know, even on the day that he was executed, he went in there with a bald head, and the comment was, oh, That's surprising. I wonder why Timothy McVeigh has his head shaved and the thing is because he's a Nazi skinhead. That's why. He didn't go bald, which happens to the best of us. Damn it. But, no, he was a Nazi. That was what he was telling you, man. And, you know, to him, this was taking credit and protecting his friends, you know? But at the same time, you know, in his last moment, expressing his solidarity with that movement, you know? I mean, for them to be so blind. Yeah. And again, going back to one of your first questions there, while blaming everybody who was a right-wing patriot-type populist for being a Nazi, while letting the actual Nazis go, you know, yeah. Blaming a million innocent people for the actions of a guilty 15 still on the loose. And by the way, Richard Guthrie later committed suicide in his cell by hanging like 6 months later, that the real Richard Guthrie. A lot of those guys have also met pretty grim fates.
Some of them are still out. Are some still out there?
Yeah, in fact, you can find interviews of Andre Strassmeyer. He's been interviewed a couple of times. I'll say, you know how, you know, you'll see on like the Learning Channel, the Discovery Channel, they'll have the conspiracy files. What's really going on at Area 51 or whatever? But at the end, no, that's a bad example. Something that's true, but that they want to, you know, downplay, right? Something like Oklahoma City is a good example. Conspiracy files, a bunch of kind of nonsense about Oklahoma that's easy to dismiss it while ignoring the real stuff. Well, they have a thing like that in Britain on BBC called the conspiracy files there. And it's basically the same thing, and yet it's a lot fairer take on it because they have a lot less of a dog in the fight, you know? And in fact, a lot of British journalists did a lot of great work on this, like Ambrose Evans Pritchard, who wrote The Secret Life of Bill Clinton that I was talking about earlier. Who writes for the Telegraph. But they did one of these that's pretty fair. And that was where, you know, they found Danny Colson saying, yeah, they really should have a new grand jury and look at all these Nazis who, you know, I'm pretty convinced were behind it, et cetera. At the same time, they show one of the guys from Elohim City, the son of the old patriarch. The old patriarch was Robert Millar, and this is John Millar, his son. And, you know, contrary to my narrative, he says, you know what? I like conspiracy theories, man. That's kind of part of my whole culture. That's what we all kind of believe in out here, the New World Order and whatever. But I got to tell you, this stuff about what was going on here is just not right. Like, just because you want to believe it and it makes sense to you that it fits or whatever, but it just isn't true that the Oklahoma bombing plot was hatched from here, you know? So now, maybe that's overstating it, and maybe the case is just this is where a lot of these men had made their associations together. Or maybe he's really right that people read too much into that. But it sure seems to me like they don't want to get to the bottom of that at all. I think if you read the Oklahoma bombing, that book by Gumbel and Charles that I mentioned, that Gumbel really dumbed down the argument of Charles, Roger Charles, and J.D. Cash. But this is a lot of their work in there. But this is sort of the slimmest, easiest to digest and accept as possible version of the story of these guys being involved in it. And I think it's still pretty damn impressive if you look at it, you know. And again, it's this guy Gumbel's a Guardian journalist, and he writes like a real reporter, not a crank, you know. So it's not perfect. I wish it was more radical, but I think for proving it to your mom or whatever, not whoever, that it is obviously can withstand a lot of scrutiny, better than me probably.
Cool. Well, I know you were, let's get off this talk. Were you in Jersey yesterday giving a speech about the book?
Yeah, that was great, man. Those guys were cool. It was the State Libertarian Party of New Jersey, their convention.
Cool.
And I gave the keynote.
Cool. You talked about Fool's Errand.
Yeah, it was basically the same speech. I don't know if you saw the video. I posted a couple speeches in a row that are the same speech about Afghanistan. One that was on C-SPAN, and then another that I did at Middle East Books and More in D.C. The C-SPAN one was for the Pennsylvania State Libertarian Party Convention.
Cool.
And then I did Middle East Books and More. That was really the best version of it, I think. And then I did one last night. I kind of changed it up just a little bit by adding some Ron Paul love at the beginning. Other than that, it's more or less the same. I always screw up and leave out one point or another. I think I left out the mountains and the deserts and the landlocked isolation and distance and that kind of point. in my speech yesterday. There was something else I omitted too. But anyway, otherwise, it's more or less the same fool's errand speech that, first of all, why is all Jimmy Carter through Bill Clinton's fault? And then second of all, why we, well, and also why Al-Qaeda wanted us to invade the country. And then why we shouldn't have invaded at all. Why even then we still didn't have to fight the Taliban, only Al-Qaeda. Or even then, okay, but we still didn't have to create a new government and fight all its enemies. And then now that we're doing that, we can't win. And now we need to just quit. And so that's basically the book. And that's basically the same speech too. Yeah. You know, and then at the end about, again, fulfilling bin Laden's wish to break the American empire on the rocks of Afghanistan. So why wait until he's all the way succeeded in his mission? Why not pull out when we're still only 7/10 of the way through, you know?
It seems when you take into consideration the article that Will Porter and Kyle Anzalone did about the record poppy crop from 2017, that the seeing what the Taliban's going to do this year, especially with Trump talking about, you know, maybe ramping up, getting a little more aggressive there, it seems like that Taliban can be well equipped by the time the spring offensive rolls around.
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny. I just interviewed Andrew Coburn, wrote this thing for Harper's. Andrew Coburn, who wrote this thing for Harper's, about how a lot of this story about the Taliban tax windfall off the poppy crop is way overblown, and that that the UN and the American numbers are way high there, and that, you know, in fact, they can still only tax 2 or 3% without it backfiring on them and this and that. So they make some millions of dollars, but, you know, the bottom line is they're 40% of the population are the Pashtuns, and they don't have any political representation other than criminal warlords who prey on them or the Taliban. And the criminal warlords being the ones backed by the Americans and the American government in Kabul there. So, you know, even David Petraeus said that the Taliban system of civil and criminal court, and in other words, resolving disputes between people on the ground, being their security force in their day-to-day life, is far superior to whatever so-called democratic forms the Americans and the international so-called community, NATO allies and whoever, have tried to foist on them. It just, you know, and so therefore the people there prefer it. They prefer independence. Imagine that. You know, they're like Texans. You know, Patrick Coburn told me one time that, I guess it was a Pakistani military officer who told him, you have to understand that to the Pashtuns, resistance against invaders is the very core of their self-identity. This is who they are, is defenders from invaders. You know, we think of Texans, we like to think of ourselves like that from the Alamo and whatever, that one time back in 1836, you know, we hadn't defended a damn thing since then. These are people who live constant aggression from all directions and always win because they won't give up because that's their thing. And so, you know, it's funny because right now they're talking about maybe they should have a power sharing arrangement. They could go ahead and make them a political party and try to split some of the Taliban from the others, which is, you know, it ain't going to work overall anyway. But they're talking about bringing them into the government of Kabul to share in the monopoly government there instead of just letting them be autonomous and independent in their own semi-state in their own land, you know. And so now, you know, they're inviting severe competition and backstabbing and truck bombing and God knows what in civil war over control of the capital city, which is, you know, the whole history of the 90s and very well could be the whole history of the 20s here, when it didn't have to be like that. Just let them go. What the hell? You know, why incorporate them? And this is why, I mean, really, I think that the Americans, we should have to just leave. Don't negotiate with the Taliban because your negotiation would be the wrong thing anyway. You can't get the Americans to agree because they can't save any face that way. They can just quit and say, I don't care, and just leave, save face by saying you don't care. That's better than making a deal with the Taliban. They won't do it. And even if they did, it would be the wrong deal. So just forget it and let these people work things out. And I think, you know, at that point, And I've been assured by this by real journalists who know their stuff on the show before when I've asked them that the Taliban, too, are so sick of fighting and they don't want to take over the whole country. And they wouldn't have Pakistani and Saudi support probably at this point anyway to take over the whole country. They just want more or less independence for Pashtunistan. So let them have it and leave. These weren't the guys that attacked us. Remember in September, October, November, and ever since, but especially just right after 9/11, how quickly and easily they did the bait and switch between Al-Qaeda and the Taliban? Mm-hmm. Even this is a truther argument that, come on, as though a bunch of Taliban cavemen could attack us in a sophisticated plot like this. But it was like, dude, it wasn't the Taliban who did it, damn it. They tried to warn us that an attack was coming. That's a fact. I got my notes. It's in my book. You can buy it. And so, you know, we could just call the whole thing off, man. I really think politically speaking, Trump could call the whole thing off and it would only help him to just say, this is all Bush and Obama's fault. McMaster's gone. He already didn't succeed. Let's just quit now. Why not? Why the hell not, man? God.
Well, I did a podcast with Will Porter about that article that he wrote, and somebody asked me a question, and I was trying to research it, and I was hoping maybe you had some information on it. This person was challenging the fact that the Taliban would have anything to do with opium, that historically they would cut off the hands of opium growers and things like, you know.
And no. Well, look, they had a big war on drugs crackdown for a while there, but that wasn't for moral reasons. That's just because there was a glut. They were trying to drive up the price. I mean, they were... You know, ever since America helped make it this way through Gulbuddin Hekmatyar's operation in the 1980s, in the war against the Soviet Union there, more and more the country has become dependent on opium. And so, you know, all sides are dependent on it. And the Taliban absolutely have been involved in growing and distributing it and taxing the hell out of it and engaging in international trade of it, before they ever banned it. And I actually read one thing that said that they had huge warehouses full of this stuff and they couldn't get rid of it all. And so that was really a big part of why they banned it in the very late 90s for a couple of years there. They cracked down really hard on production in order, you know, just to protect the price of their own, stockpile, you know, their inventory glut or whatever you call it in business there. And so, I don't know, that may be, you know, an extreme take on it, but it actually sounds pretty truthful to me. And they absolutely tax opium farmers, in Helmand Province, which they dominate, other than the provincial capital. The Helmand Province belongs to the Taliban, in the daytime and at night. And so, and that's, you know, the heart of all the opium in the country. You know, I guess the question really is, you know, the hyperbolic part of it is that they tax at like 20% and they make all these tens of billions of dollars and all this stuff where that's just, you know, overblown. Now that I think about it, I may have cited those overblown statistics in my book about just how well the Taliban benefits from that. But I should go back and check that. But I mean, the point remains, though, that they absolutely are in the business of it. I mean, you know, not necessarily directly, but if you, you know, check out this great article by Andrew Coburn in Harper's, because a lot of what he talks about is, you know, kind of what Taliban, you know, the Taliban is broken into so many pieces now, and in Helmand Province, it's really just this tribe versus that tribe. And you might call them the Taliban, but really they're just drug dealers fighting over domination of the heroin trade. So I guess there's a gray area there, right? When the Taliban become such drug dealers that they're not the Taliban anymore, you know, something like that. It seems to be, it's the heart of the insurgency against American and Kabul power there, though.
Talk about the book. I know it's in audio now, and anything else you want to plug?
Oh, hell, just I've done a lot of interviews. If you like listening to interviews of things, for years I promised, and I had a lot of people promise me they're going to help me do it, to put the archive on YouTube. And it's now there at youtube.com/Scott Horton Show, 4,600 something interviews. They're all there. And they're all also at my site, scotthorton.org. And I got all the RSS feeds and all that kind of thing. And then I run the Libertarian Institute with Sheldon Richman. And yeah, I wrote this book, Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan. And it is like you said, an audiobook now, if people are interested, and that's at foolserrand.us. And I don't know. I tweet angry garbage all day at Scott Horton's show on there.
Antiwar.com, too.
Oh, yeah, I'm the opinion editor at antiwar.com. So basically the viewpoints there are my pick.
Cool, man. Well, always a pleasure. This was I wanted to talk about this one because, you know, I wanted to talk about this subject, specifically the subject of Oklahoma City, because, you know, I had I've been trying to do this a lot lately. You hooked me up with Dan Gifford, who, you know, I was able to do a great show on Waco. You also hooked me up with Jeremy Hammond, where we've done two, you know, his podcast with 2 hours and 5 minutes on Israel-Palestine.
Yeah, which was great, which I listened to, yeah.
It was just...
I have this horrible rule that I won't interview anybody till I read their book, but then I don't ever read anybody's book, so I'm just stuck. You know, I didn't interview Michael Hastings for 2 years before he died, just because I hadn't gotten a chance to finish The Operators yet.
Oh.
Which is the dumbest fucking thing, but anyway.
So
that's how I am, man.
So, yeah,
I want to read that book, and I want to interview the hell out of him, you know, 2 hours to start, maybe.
But the Obstacle to Peace? Just the first two chapters are, they're stomach churning.
I have a brand new, speaking of 2 hour things, I have a 2 hour interview of Jonathan Schwartz from The Intercept, formerly of The Tiny Revolution, all about how they lied us into Iraq War II that I did on the anniversary last week. And I have another one coming out that's 2 hours with Gareth Porter about how Iraq War II played out and all the most important stuff that happened in the war as it went and how it led to where we're at now. So if people are interested in that, that's all out there, scotthorton.org again, or it will be.
Yeah, I started listening to the Schwartz interview this morning. It was already getting good.
Cool.
But, yeah, so, you know, thanks for everything. I appreciate it. And
thank you, man.
Yeah, man. Anytime.
I need a chance to get this stuff off my chest sometimes. I like it when people interview me.
I'm waiting for you. I'm waiting.
I'm always asking everybody else what they say.
I'm waiting for you to come speak around here, even like one or two states away, so I can come in
the
area. Hang on. I'm in Georgia.
Oh, in Georgia. Okay.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Even if you go to Florida somewhere. What?
And invite me to it. I'll come and give a speech. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to take that. I'm going to get somebody to edit together some good clips. I think I already have a guy, actually, who's going to cut together some clips from the C-SPAN speech and a couple others. And I'm going to try to give speeches to more Libertarian Party state conventions, because it seems like there's 50 of those.
Yeah.
And a lot of them really do care about this stuff. So maybe if I can pitch that speech to them, I can sell some books that way and help get the word out. So far, both of these Libertarian conventions, I've tried to say, like, you know, the National Party has really missed a huge opportunity to make the Libertarian Party the vanguard anti-war party in America this whole time. And it's in the Libertarian Party's interest to do so. Never mind, you know, that it's the right moral thing to do. But from a public choice theory kind of a thing, this is our comparative advantage. Why would we forsake it? You know, this is... Libertarians stay anti-war when liberals are in power. So how about we exploit that for our own gain by demanding these people go to prison for war crimes, by demanding the empire's abolished immediately, by being as hardcore and as radical on all of these anti-war positions as we can possibly be. Abolish NATO immediately. We don't need a Pentagon at all. Open back up the little office of the War Department. That's all we need because, you know, the empire's over now. And these kind of arguments, and because it's the right thing and because it's what's good for the party. And I think, you know, both cases in Pennsylvania and New Jersey, I had a lot of people who agreed with that and who, even if they were like, huh, then I won them over with it. And they really, you know, I think are buying that. And wouldn't you love to see the Libertarian Party, you know, instead of being a bunch of Gary Johnsons up there, actually really have their act together and know what they're talking about and try their very best to lead the way in opposing this stuff the way the Libertarian movement does.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of Libertarian Party members do believe that. They're just, you know, maybe haven't been motivated to really or really see it that way, that it should be the paramount issue here. But that's what I think.
Yeah, so I mean, I didn't even come to all this through the Libertarian Party. I came through Ron Paul, who was a Republican.
Right. Damn it. See, this is what I meant to say at the end in my speech, because I started with Ron Paul, and I had this whole line I was going to say, which I've said before, that, you know, the Libertarian Party always runs as, like, soft Republicans. But why would anybody ever vote for the Republican who can't possibly win when there's already an actual Republican on the ballot? They'll just vote for him if that's what they want to do. So it doesn't really make sense to be Republicans but who are pro-bro job or pro-pot or whatever. That's just not enough. And then I said, but look at Ron Paul. Here's a guy who is personally conservative and is literally a Republican in Congress, but takes a radical libertarian position on everything, and he changes the whole world. It's because of the position that he took, and because of the brutal honesty of it all, and because of this is right and this is wrong of it all. And people knew that, hey, this old man respects me enough to tell me the truth and all of this and that. That was what everybody liked about him so much, that, you know, he showed the lesson to the Libertarian Party. There should be absolutely clear that culturally you can be whatever you want, but libertarianly you better be radical as hell, or else what the hell are we even doing here?
Man, let me tell you something. If the LP started getting really radical again, I mean, if for nothing else, just to get that word out there, just to get the message out there, you know, I would help. But it's just not, I mean, the Libertarian Party now is, it's not even Republican light. It's actually even crossed over into weird campusy stuff where they're just, they don't want to offend people by saying certain things. And it's just, that's the national party. I mean, you're talking to people in the state party, I'm sure.
Well, I mean, I'm trying to get them to change the national party because it's up to them to do it. But yeah, I mean, no, I know what you mean. I've heard about some of this. But you know what? So everybody slams this guy, Sarwak, which I don't know much about him. I know he fought with Tom Woods, and I'm totally a pro-Tom Woods partisan as far as all that goes. But I'm also the kind of guy who doesn't care about stuff like that. And because I think stopping the war in Yemen is best. And I didn't get very far with this at all, but I was trying to get different libertarian groups, and including the Libertarian Party, to try to support HCON Res 81 last fall to try to stop the war in Yemen against the Houthis. And, you know, I don't know all the details, but from what I heard, Sarwak was for it and wanted to join, you know, sign on and be part of it. And it was other members of the Libertarian National Committee that killed it.
So,
you know, I can work with that, you know, whatever your problem is with being offended about something or whatever. If you're offended about Yemeni genocide first, then you can come with me or I'll try to support you. And, you know, that's my thing, too, is that, like, I'll help, too. If you can find me a candidate who wants to learn this stuff and then fight all about it like hell, then I'm the guy who will tell you the truth about the things so that you can... do it well, you know.
I mean,
no problem.
I have no problem helping these people, but you know, it's got to be. It goes right back to 2007. That whole revolution that happened was anti-war. I mean, what did he talk about? He caught so much shit because he was anti-war, because he said, you know, they hate us because we're over there. And that was like the worst thing that you could, I mean, you know, 6 years after 9/11, that was absolutely the worst thing that you could say. And I'm actually like, yeah, that fucking makes sense to me. If someone was coming into my backyard, you know, and shitting and shooting my dog, yeah, it'd be fucking.
And now this was the moment for you?
Yeah.
So that's how I began my speech yesterday was, you know, who here loves Ron Paul? That's an easy line, right? So they all applaud. But then I said, so who all here is here because Ron Paul changed their life that day he fought with Rudy Giuliani in the big Giuliani moment? And there are about four or five hands. But I've met so many people and heard from so many people who that was the day.
Yeah.
You know?
That was the day my life. That was the day my life changed. And that was even Dave Smith says that was the day his life changed.
Yep, that's right.
You know, and now we're lunatics out there screaming. You know, and I've told people have approached me from the Libertarian Party, and I'm like, they're like, what do we need to do? And I fucking send them a Ron Paul video from 2007 and say, do that. Get somebody who can say that and believe it. Do that. You don't need any new bullshit. Do that.
Yeah.
You know, and
yeah, who needs a gimmick when you have actual power to run against. It's not like there's a lack of important issues to bring up. You got to resort to nonsense.
Yeah, man.
All right. Well, hey, I'm sorry because you already introduced me a while back.
No, don't worry about it, bro. That was.
Thanks for having me again, dude. Yeah. I love talking with you.
All right, man. I'll talk to you later. Take care.
All right. See ya.
I want to thank you for tuning in to the Free Man Beyond the Wall podcast. I want to thank Scott for coming on. Remind you about my book, Freedom Through Memedom. It's on Amazon. I should be coming back at you in the middle of the week with another podcast. So take care. Have a good week. Bye.